bezig gehad met theorieën van Baudrillard, met web van hijzelf, met films, science fiction films. En de relaties die daar tussen legt, dat wil ik graag aan haar overlaten. Judith is geen onbekende hier in Nederland. Ze is vorig jaar hier geweest. Er zijn meerdere teksten van haar gepubliceerd in Museumjournaal en Modern Denken. Ze heeft op dit moment een installatie die morgen opengaat op het Apollohuis. En ze houdt vanavond een verhaal. Een lezing die al in het vorig jaar afgesproken was, in de tijd dat Judith hier ook was, ook in relatie met een tentoonstelling op ICA vorig jaar. En ik wou een paar dingen zeggen. Judith heeft een heel uitgebreide achtergrond. Ze is begonnen architectuur te studeren. Ze heeft zich veel met film bezig gehouden. Ze heeft zich bezig gehouden met de sound editing van een film van Francis Ford Coppola, die iedereen waarschijnlijk al gezien heeft, Apocalypse Now. Ze is sinds 1976 beeldend kunstenaar, maakt installaties en videotapes, maar noemt zichzelf geen videokunstenaar. Zit tussen al die gebieden in. En ik denk dat u dat vanavond wel zult merken, ook aan haar lezing. Die ongeveer een uur duurt en waarna ze heel nieuwsgierig is ook om met het publiek dat hier vanavond is, van gedachten erover te wisselen. Judith, I think the best thing is for you to begin. Please use me as my light.
If you don't understand my English, stop me and I'll explain. I'm going to try not to be overly academic and use words that you don't understand, but if I do, I don't mind. You won't hurt my feelings or make me lose my train of thought if you ask me a question. So please feel free to do that. And maybe Saskia can translate it or Rimko or Paul or somebody. What I'm going to give you is an excerpt from a much longer project of mine, which deals a lot with questions around mass culture, specifically questions that various people writing today are addressing, but not really taking as far as I think they should go, and particularly in the context of art. This particular piece of what I'm working on does relate to two other articles that have been translated into Dutch. One was published by Paul in Museumjournaal, and one was in Modern Denken. And I don't know if you've read them, but rather than repeat those articles, I am going to set out a few ideas from those articles and then try to build on them a little bit here. What I will be talking about today will be mostly the work of Jean Baudrillard in a particular book called Circulations, which is published by Semiotext recently this year, and it's sort of taken the New York art world by storm, so that all of a sudden everyone is reading Baudrillard on the subway, and it's a little tiny book that's about, I don't think I brought my copy, but it's the kind of book that's perfect for reading on the subway. It's almost like a little newspaper or something. It's real little, and when you read it, it's a very interesting book because it reads the way a novel reads or science fiction reads, where it's very fast, there aren't any big words in it, no footnotes to speak of, maybe four or five, and you can kind of consume it rapidly, so that it's kind of, it gives you, in the French way, a kind of pleasure of the text, which personally I enjoy. So my particular reading of this is going to be based very specifically on that particular book. And I just would be curious, are people familiar with Baudrillard, or should I go into detail about? Okay, well, basically, I guess I should go into detail. Basically, what he writes about, he started out as a sociologist, which is why it's kind of funny for us to be in this room, in this building, which is a sociology school. And what he and also Foucault have done, in a certain sense, I think, and this is, I mean, you can disagree with me, please do, I think, is that they have revived sociology and they've kept it from falling into kind of a statistical morass where you can use, if you look at philosophy and you look at the philosophy of statistics, you can use a statistic any way you want to. And you can see it, if you read early Baudrillard, you can sort of see his sociological, statistical bias in the work in a very particular way. When Foucault and Baudrillard come along, and Baudrillard comes out of the situationalist movement Is everybody familiar with the situationalist? Okay, I think that you would. So you can see that that's the place where he begins. And as he moves along in his thinking, he takes that one crucial idea of the situationalist, particularly Guy Debord, the idea of the spectacle, and tries to question what it is that the spectacle actually means in contemporary society. And in Simulations book is the book where he most closely tries to address those questions. What he calls a spectacle is actually something he calls the hyperreal, which is something that science fiction writers have been writing about for a long time, particularly American science fiction writers.
The hyperreal.
Science fiction?
No, the hyperreal.
The hyperreal, which even sounds like a science fiction term. I mean, it doesn't really have any meaning, except it sort of seems like it's cybernetics or something like that. So he's taken what Baudrillard has done in a way, although I'm sure he's not that familiar with American science fiction because it's mostly downgraded and people, you know, academics don't read it, it's trash, and so on, he's taken a lot of those ideas and given them a sort of academic form within the academic world in a way. And I think that there is a real relationship, which is why tonight I am going to show you excerpts from science fiction films and also excerpts from pieces of my work and also some slides of various kinds of representation. Because what I'm going to try to address is something that he definitely leaves out, which I think is really important, which is what happens to the body when, according to his theory, the body disappears, it dissolves into the hyperreal, and nothing is real anymore. Because what happens to the body means what happens to subjectivity. And it seems to me that the French philosophers of the last 10 years or longer actually have been really concerned with subjectivity and constructing subjectivity. And in Baudrillard's, in Simulations, he takes off from Marx and tries to talk about value and ways in which value is constructed. And he starts off in the Renaissance period of time, the 16th century, and he goes through the whole idea of perspective, but through perspective as a kind of counterfeit. And that is perspective as a sort of imitation or a copy. And from there, he moves into the early industrial period where you have another production relationship that's characterized by a certain historical possibility, which is the Industrial Revolution. And value is created very specifically through a kind of equivalence. And the paradigm there is the robot, where it's not a copy anymore, but it can perform the same functions that man performs. And then you move on to the present day, where you have the paradigm of the computer. And it's really one code speaking to another code. So does that give you enough background to sort of follow me, or should I talk more? How the body is represented is also part of how the body is seen in like, and you can see it, and I didn't bring slides of this, but you can see it in the plan of the Renaissance building where you don't have a corridor. You have one room that opens into another room that opens into another room that opens into another room. You have no such thing as private space yet, and you have no such thing as privacy. People really live kind of on top of each other. So the body is very central to how it is that people figure out how they are in relationship to one another, although it's, again, thought about really, really differently. After perspective comes into general being, you have people like Velázquez, and this painting, Las Meninas, which has been analyzed a lot by Foucault and other people, and then you have a Cubist painting by Picasso, which is another form of analysis, and you have a very different system for representation, very much spelled out historically within these two different contexts. So somewhere you get from, this through this, which is another kind of representation, to the photograph, which, as Walter Benjamin once said, trying to get an original copy of a photograph is a pretty ridiculous endeavor because the meaning is really kind of lost. To this. So that the body becomes, the body throughout, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I'm trying to develop a paradigm for looking, for questioning the relationship of the body in representation, so I can get up to the present day, which, and its forms of representation, which for me are not painting and sculpture, although I like painting and sculpture, I'm not against it, but are more mass cultural forms of representation, which are television and film. And it seems to me that those are the kinds of representations that most directly affect people's lives. To go back to Baudrillard a lot, and why I particularly want to pick and picking Baudrillard is because in his development of this sort of schema of the hyperreal and the fact that we live in a universe, according to Baudrillard, in the hyperreal, we live in a universe where all of our real things no longer refer to anything real, but they only refer to a simulation of what was real. And he uses the paradigm of Disneyland as being what, for Americans, is now the real, because it covers over the fact that we no longer have anything that's real. So we have this other paradigm that's Disneyland. Now, there's a certain amount of truth to that, particularly if you live in a place like Los Angeles, where you don't have a city center, or you're driving around in your car, and the way you construct your relationship to your real space is more on the level of a kind of montage, where you'll look one way and put something together, and look another way and put something together, and it won't be, it's not the same thing as walking from point to point, and it's not centered around the city center the way perhaps it is for you. I don't really know, because I'm not a European, and I haven't ever lived in Europe. But so there is a certain kind of truth in that, but there are quite a number of things that Baudrillard's point of view doesn't really take into account. And it's in taking, I think that questioning this relationship to the body and ultimately to the construction of subjectivity is an extremely important question, because it has ramifications throughout the history of, say, recent, since 1945, mass cultural perspectives such as Adorno, the Frankfurt Sociology School, and certainly to art and art's relationship to culture, especially if you want to look in the realm of political art, because one crucial orientation to this perspective is a question that Frederick Jameson is brought out, where he talks a lot about the difference between affect, which, how would you say affect, A-F-F-E-C-T, and effect, E-F-F-E-C-T. He makes the distinction between affect as being the production of anxiety in the speaking subject, and effect, which is what we would be under say Baudrillard's system of the hyper-real, where nothing is real, as an effect of technology, and how it's the lure of technology and the lure of mass culture that have taken away the possibility of affect, the possibility of anxiety, and the kind of possibility of sort of a real level of experience. And so that's why this is particularly interesting to me. These are just various kinds of representations of the body as it turns kind of inward in the history of art. And again, I'm not going to talk very much about this. I'm just showing you a few slides just to give you a reference point. This is a 17th century painting. This is an 18th century painting. It's really generally. This is a late 18th century painting. And you all, I'm sure you all know what this is anyway, so, and probably many of you know a lot more about this part of art history than I do. But they all take up the body in very particular ways. Just to show you how important it is. And then there's this one. Get into the sort of political, which is country or meld together some environment that was uninhabitable. And they would actually stage a pageant and show how it was done to the audience that they wanted to reach. And then they would all, at the end of it, they'd all get down and dance together. And it was like, I don't know, sometimes it worked. So it's a pretty interesting form of the spectacle, and it had a lot to do more with, unlike, say, public theaters, which is what Palladio's theater was, it had a lot more to do with the state theater and beginning of statehood in a particular way, and not to do much with this idea of the city that I'm talking about, although I'm going to pick this up a little bit later. this is the Cuvio Pavilion in Nymphenburg outside of Munich, and this is one of the places that in Baudrillard's book, I just thought I'd show it to you, that he talks about as being, he talks about stucco angels and Rococo buildings standing as for copies of things. But I wanted to show this because I think it's a much more fascinating building. When you stand in the middle of this building where that person is at the end, a very strange kind of special effect happens right to the body. And on a sunny day, I was lucky to be there in the spring, right in the sort of early part of the spring, when you get quite a lot of light. When you stand in the center of this room, these are mirrors alternating with windows that are in a round shape that go around. And when the light hits you from all around and the mirrors reflect it, your body basically dissolves and disappears. So it was at the time of this sort of sun god, sun kings, and it produced a very visible, direct effect on spectators when they have, this is actually a little hunting lodge for pheasants, but it's a pretty interesting kind of special effect that was built into the architecture. I'm sure you have quite a lot of things like that at home that I don't know about. Anyway, this is another kind of theater space. And there's actually a little show right outside here. This is one of the operating tables from the 19th century where animals were operated on in theatrical spaces. And quite a few people have been writing about this. Most recently, Alan Sekulow, I don't know if you know his work, or John Kopchak from October, have both written about the relationship between operating in anatomy theaters, which is what these were, on dogs, assuming that animals were like people, and the relationship between that and other diseases of the 19th century, like hysteria and melancholy in particular. Anyway, another thing that Baudrillard talks about in his book is this sort of the second phase of capitalism, which is the sort of industrial revolution production relationship, where you have these equivalent values created, and he uses a paradigm of the Bauhaus. And this isn't the Bauhaus. I couldn't really find a really good picture of the Bauhaus that represented that point of view, but this particular drawing, which is called Plan for Living, shows kind of an ideal social relationship. And you remember with the Bauhaus, there was a function, a place for everything, and everything was function. And you can sort of see how the room is arranged so that the center is, instead of being filled, is quite vacant. Which seems to be a function that is. This is another Renaissance plan, which I've talked about a lot, and which I keep going back to. It's something in the 14th century that was developed by a guy whose name is Giulio Camilio, and it's actually a prototype for the first computer. And it's as you can see, an amphitheater, and all of those little, what look like stairs going up to it, are actually various levels of knowledge and sort of the ascension of knowledge. And you can see the only word I can make out is Apollo, unfortunately. But each of those little blocks represents a certain kind of knowledge, and supposedly this was never built. I don't know if it was built or not. It was bought by King Ferdinand of Spain. But by standing in the middle of this theater, absorb all the knowledge that was in the universe. So you can see that you could go both up it and down it and then sideways. So it contained those synchronic and diachronic kinds of relationships. And supposedly, it was an alchemical relationship as well. So supposedly, by absorbing all this knowledge, you and your body would disappear completely and you would ascend into heaven. And there was a real relationship between a lot of the people who were working with alchemy and actually early science, including Descartes, who was actually an alchemist, and people like John Dee, Shakespeare. A lot of those people were really involved in this kind of work. This is kind of a present day representation of Baudrillard, in a sense, because I'm going to show you a series of these where it's very difficult to tell who's the mannequin and who isn't. Can you tell? I mean, these are just snapshots in department stores. I mean, you can sort of tell, you know, but again, here. So, anyway, this sort of gets me up to film, which I think is a real interesting. The reason why I guess I want to talk about the body and film in relationship to Baudrillard's ideas, and this probably isn't so clear from what I've been saying, I've just been trying to give you a background about a certain history of the body, is that I think that in kind of popular representations that we all consume, and even Baudrillard says in his book that we basically are in a situation where we no longer are producing anything. We live in a world where our universe basically has no meaning, and that's okay with us. And we live in a world where we're given one image to consume after another, and they're all interchangeable, and they all don't sort of mean anything. But I think it's interesting to consider film and its relationship to, on a very specific level, to questions around the body. And I'm certainly going to do that a little bit through film theory, because I think it's useful in this context because first of all, with film theory, as you already know, there's nothing real there anyway. No matter what you're looking at with a film, no matter what you're liking so much, it doesn't exist. It's on film. And usually, even as we all know from years of watching the Garth movies and other movies too, usually, even if it is a documentary, even if it is supposed to stand for real or something true, it actually doesn't. It's actually a fabrication of some kind or another. So that, I think, and you were saying this earlier, I think that it is interesting to consider futurists and certain tendencies right at this change between, say, early, or not early, but middle production-oriented Baudrillard in terms of his concept of the equivalence and something being equivalent, say the robot, or certain questions that Marinetti had or Hugo Ball had about the body and how it is that the body is seen, in terms of the ways in which the body changes and we sort of accept a lot of things about the body and take them sort of for granted. And you can see that, I think, more in the history or the early cinema as it develops through, say, The Student of Prague, where you have the idea of the doppelganger, which I don't know if you, is everybody familiar with that? Which is a kind of 19th century idea where you double yourself, but if you ever see yourself double, you have this irrepressible desire to kill your double. And there have been a lot of people, Jeff Wall, for instance, and several other people have made works using the title doppelganger very deliberately in their work. And this is a film from the 30s called The Student of Prague, where that's exactly what happens, the doppelganger. This is a film from 1926 that is called The Student of Prague, which is about this doppelganger effect and this kind of irrepressible desire to kill your double. overused. It's sort of related to the whole question of photography, if you look at it in terms of, say, primitive peoples and the idea that the photograph captures the soul. I think there's some relationship to that, although the myth of the doppelganger is very old. Pardon me? I can't hear you.
The body
snatchers. The body snatchers, yeah, well, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's interesting, because in a lot of ways, Hollywood is just kind of reviving a lot of these old myths in an attempt to kind of hang on to certain things, which I want to show. But there are other kind of 19th century ideas that I also think are very interesting, which I'm not going to talk about very much, but the whole idea of the vampire is an extremely interesting idea, and you can sort of, and it does relate to Baudrillard, but that's a whole other lecture in itself. But the whole idea that you can somehow live forever by actually being dead, even to take it in its most simple way, by drinking blood, is a really interesting concept. And when you consider it over a long historical period, it's very interesting to see how it sort of plays itself out from the 19th century into the 20th century, where you have a kind of a vampire effect, but not any vampires anymore, but it's still become this kind of, it's sort of been glamorized. You can sort of see it somewhat in, well, there was a glamorous David Bowie movie, I don't know if it came here. Did it come here? Yeah. For instance, but in many other ways. You can also see, on a certain level, the myth of the vampire in architecture, and particularly, I think, this is my own idea, and probably nobody would agree with this, but I think you can see it in the glass office building, particularly the black glass office building, where from high up, you look down at the people, and you're behind this kind of glass box, which usually is tinted, especially, for instance, Mies van der Rohe buildings, which is sort of, I guess, a paradigm building. And that kind of vampirism feeds on a certain sort, and I'm using it, I realize, very metaphorically, but it feeds on a certain relationship to power, which takes over a certain relationship to the city that doesn't, that is very different from, say, a Renaissance idea of the city, where you have the city and the theater idealized. Now we have a faceless building that tries to lose itself behind a facade which is basically unreadable, which is the glass office building. And you have a person behind that who's anonymous, and yet who is extremely powerful. But anyway, that's another. You know, I'm just going to go through these. This isn't Caspar David Friedrich. It's a Lang film where he obviously was influenced by the whole early 18th century idea of man in relationship to his environment. What happens in the 18th century in terms of, in the early 19th century in terms of my argument, is how the individual comes to have a certain kind of bourgeois subjectivity, and how that's developed through the shopping arcade, through the novel, through the whole relationship to, again, hysteria, where you can see it in women, it only afflicts women, whereas men are afflicted with something called melancholia, which is kind of, as one person put it, the disease of kings, where you have no desire for anything, which is very, kind of very different than the question that surrounds women and hysteria, and there were no male hysterics. And then through that, you come once again to a period of time where subjectivity is... tied very completely to family and the ways in which the family is still not focused. The ways in which the family is regulated also has a determining. very kind of utopian, the whole utopian bent of Fourier and other people like that. So that the way the body is thought of as the 18th and 19th century progresses is in terms of a kind of social utopia that really hasn't existed before then, although it starts to come back as cinema starts to take over in the form of almost what you could call a kind of return of the repressed, where I find it very interesting that in the work of a lot of the early, particularly German filmmakers, there's this real fascination with Der Golem and The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which I think I next slide up, or even in Lang's film Metropolis, where you have this real questioning of the industrial structure, which you can kind of see in a way that no film that we have today really kind of questions that. Where these are pictures of workers and they have their heads bound. They're very sort of archetypical. Or this is kind of a picture of Superman, and he's very, very much a robot, very much an automaton. And I think in futurism, with the work of Hugo Ball and other people, you can find instances which is very, where there's a very ambiguous relationship between what exactly does it mean that there's this equivalence between man and a machine, and you must feel it in your work because you have this real relationship to it, which I find, you know, it's a very interesting kind of thing to take up as a practice, which doesn't, that's the canon of Dr. Caligari. These are just kind of random stills from films. You also have at the same time, in order to represent these relationships that, and this is really kind of one of the cornerstones of what I'm trying to get at is, why is it these relationships that are so crucial are not representable in any other way except through a resort to something that doesn't actually exist, which becomes a sort of special effect. And if you go back historically to the early Renaissance period and you look at how perspective actually finds its way into sort of daily life, many of the drawings that were done during the time of the Renaissance were drawings of things that actually could not exist. They were really imaginary drawings of things that people wanted or things that people thought they should have or could have. And I'm thinking of the Babini brothers. I don't know if they're probably the most, at least most accessible, because Dover Press publishes all their books for about $4.95. But there are many other people who one can look at and see that a lot of these perspectival drawings could never have been built at the time. The technology wasn't there to build it. And in a similar fashion, as we move into the present day with the sort of invention of the history of cinema, you also have a situation where many things are not able to be represented, and so they're represented through a kind of special effect. And specifically, my question is always, well, what does that mean in terms of a kind of a fascination that's produced? Is that the same fascination of effect, EFFECT, which is the lure of the technological that Jameson talks about, that Baudrillard also mentions very briefly? Or is it actually possible that that can produce an affect, AFFECT? And I don't know. I mean, I think it's for someone who, my own involvement in this has a lot to do with my own fascination with special effects. Obviously, I wouldn't be sitting up here telling you about this kind of representation if I wasn't really interested in it myself. As I said, I do have a lot of questions about where one is supposed to place oneself. So what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to show you some excerpts from different films that directly deal with the body in certain ways. Anybody recognize this image?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
Great. That's really good. Yeah, good. Yeah, it's very hard to get this photograph because, as you know, what's interesting, this is a film from, I think it was 1978. It's made by of a, you know, the deep, dark place where you don't ever want to stick your hand, or the bad cellar that you never want to go into. And it's funny, one thing I do want to say before I show this, I didn't bring that many films with me because I couldn't carry them. But one thing that's very, in what supposedly, in, at least in terms of American cinema, in what supposedly progressive cinema, i.e. Not avant-garde, but progressive mainstream cinema, most of the plots and most of the stories are extremely old. And they're not, they're sort of like, they sort of dressed up a lot of these ideas and contemporary guys, but they're basically very old stories, very old plot lines. And Alien is a really good example of a film that had, was, had a very old plot line. Does it, did everybody see that, or should I talk about it a little bit? Well, what it's about is about a group of people in a spaceship, and they go to a planet, and they decide to go down to look at this planet, and one of them, while he is looking on this planet for something, runs into an alien, or it runs into him, and suddenly it, you know, gets him right in the face, and he winds up carrying the alien back onto the spaceship. And there's a whole other subplot in the film, which actually, what's nice about film, unlike, say, many other things, is you can read this stuff many, many different ways, and this plot, being a contemporary Hollywood film, has something for women. So it has a woman character who winds up being kind of in charge of things, and a ship that winds up being kind of like a mother, and there's this whole duality going back and forth between the spaceship, the relationship of the woman to the spaceship, and to the surviving man who's not eaten by the alien. And there's a real question that's raised by the narrative about whether or not she'll survive. And the alien kind of pops up like women used to pop up in classic Hollywood cinema. When women appear, the narrative stops, you know, and that's the love scene, and then the action kind of goes along. Well, in Alien, what was really interesting is when the alien would pop up, the action would sort of stop, even though you wouldn't be able to see it, and then after the alien would leave again, the story would go on, so it kind of reversed those relationships. But anyway, you very infrequently saw the alien, and part of the reason the film was so successful, I think, was because you weren't able to represent what this unnamed horror looks like. So anyway, in terms of the body, and what I've been talking about with Baudrillard, I hope this gives us enough to get into a kind of discussion about some of this, although I don't know if it will or not. But in terms of these films and the body, I think the crucial thing to look for is the way in which subjectivity in all of these things, the films, and I will try to set this up, does become the production of both you as you watching the film, because it doesn't exist and it's not real and it's only going through the gate, and also what you sort of bring to it in terms of your own abilities to identify with it. You're constantly placed in a situation where you're sort of having to deny the body, and the body is disappearing, and it's sort of becoming something else. And the question always arises is, what would happen if you got rid of the body? I mean, it really does, even in, say, the history of feminism, there's certainly been a lot of questions that revolve around feminist essentialism. I don't know if this is a familiar argument. The power of women resides in the body. Or whether questions around the body are really beside the point, as, say, in English journals like Screen Magazine or MF, or the body is considered only as a social construction, and only, it's a very Baudrillard concept, if you wanted to use it that way, so that the body only becomes discourse and there's no real body. And I think that what a lot of these films do is that they raise that ambiguity for the spectator in a very real way, which is why they're so powerful, so that you have, you're always in, you're kept kind of on the edge of your seat watching this dissolving body occur as you're identifying with it, and at the same time, both knowing that it's not real and knowing that you have a real body. And so I think that there's, within that kind of constellation, which again, I'm talking about mass culture, it's a very powerful affect, A-F-F-E-C-T, and I think that that does produce a kind of real anxiety, which is, I guess I have to say that I think that there, on a popular level, there is a place for film on a political level to have an effect, an anxiety-producing effect, which I find one way to get out of what Baudrillard and other people have characterized as a universe with no meaning, where things only refer to each other. So the first thing I'm going to show is what in the States became sort of the beginning of science fiction cinema, and it actually takes place at the same time that the events of May of 68 were happening, which you probably all remember, I'm sure, student revolutions. It's, of course, 2001, and the scene I'm going to show is, does everybody see this film, right?
A theatrical environment. In motion control work,
There's no desire to create theater. There's a desire to create reality and to place, instead of keeping you on the outside, the way 2001 does with its special effects, which I'll put on play, so you can see. We're in all the cases of 2001.
Thanks. Oh, before we can see now motion control.
Yeah, yeah, although this one, this isn't a real great example, and in fact, it's very difficult. I brought Blade Runner with me, which is a really great example of motion control, but we didn't have a VHS player that we could get that was NTSC standard to play it on.
So Blade Runner, that was...
Any kind of motion control effect, any effect is a motion control effect once you have action. What happens is you actually have three or four pieces of film running in different directions, matted together. So there's this incredible pull on the image. That's why sometimes when you're watching the star corridor of Star Wars 2, what was it, Empire Strikes Back, you know that asteroid sequence where they're going like this?
Okay.
You kind of get, right, and your stomach kind of gets queasy. That's because visually you're sutured into that area in a way that you're not in something like 2001 where you're held way back. You know how all of those sequences, I didn't show it, but there's a sequence where in 2001 the woman is rotating, you know, she walks around, and you're way back. There's no intercutting between her and anything else because the technology at the time wouldn't let you do that.
So what are you saying is one effect at a time, basically, rather than multiple effects, and that's the
right, that's 2001. But also there's something in the image where there's more than one effect simultaneously in the image. So you have this buildup of effects that, you know, it's like one effect piled on another and another. And instead of canceling each other out, they make it seem more and more and more real so that your impression of reality is extremely heightened. And that's why you get that kind of flipping of the stomach. I mean, you can also get it from films where they shoot. Well, I mean, the classic is the kind of POV shot, point of view shot from, say, horror films, where Carrie or any of the Halloween 3 or all of those rely heavily on a point of view shot where you're also in the center of the effect. But these are different than that because they're so multiplied and because they're so specifically planned, and also because they really can't exist except as a piece of celluloid. So that's the distinction.
Thank you.
great event. It's also at the end of this tape, so we have to wait a little while. And after that, after I show this, I'd really like for some of you to ask me questions, so we have a discussion. It's not really fair to make you talk all the time. Well, it's just more interesting to talk.
But
there are
discussions.
Enlightenment, and which is basically repressed during the Enlightenment period. So So that's what I meant by showing that, and I refer to that a lot in a lot of my articles because I find it really a fascinating idea. And it also, it's a very clear idea, and it really problematizes the way in which the body is thought about in a particular time, whereas we, I think, lack that kind of clarity when we start to discuss our bodies. I mean, our body as Foucaultian has been dissected, analyzed, placed in a number of different ways and fragmented kind of beyond our control. So that even if you look at relatively recent phenomena, like in the States, we now have aerobics, where you have all these exercise classes, and women are now being taught to think about their bodies in a way that's totally as an other, as a kind of, not really a machine, but as something that they can work on and obtain. So it's a complete kind of objectification of the body, whereas you can read it the other way and think, well, this is great, women are really healthy and they're really spending time in their bodies, and this means, you know, something different is happening. But actually, there's also this other thing. And so there's all this kind of, this really kind of, the numbers of access, the access to subjectivity is so complicated in the age we live in, which is, I think, you know, Baudrillard's way of stating it in a way that's as clear as he does, much clearer than I can state it, is really of great value. And I, as I said when I began, I have a very ambiguous relationship to his writing, because on the one hand, I really, on a moral level, I find it almost offensive. But then on another level, I find it very useful to have someone finally say all of this. Because remember, this is a project that certainly doesn't start with Baudrillard. It's been happening in history for the last 15 or 20 years. And it goes through people like, like Foucault and all of the French structuralists have been talking about the impossibility of history, the end of history, and have been really fervently questioning subjectivity.
Can you say a bit more about what you mean by subjectivity? Because it's a word you use a lot, and I'm never quite clear. It seems to kind of be a very fluid word, which you seem to sort of insert in different contexts.
I probably am not real specific when I mean it in a number, but what I actually mean is sort of how one thinks about oneself, and how that's, and I use constructed very deliberately, because it is a construct. It's not a given. You aren't born into subjectivity. If you look at it from a psychoanalytic point of view, you come into subjectivity as you accede to language, and it's only as a spoken subject that you are placed in the culture. So we can't even talk about genderless, for women, we cannot talk about a genderless subjectivity, because for women, women are not men, and the culture is really, especially from a psychoanalytic point of view, extremely phallocentrically dominated. I mean, Derrida's whole project has been around the sort of problem with Western logos in terms of a kind of sort of phallocentricness of logic and metaphysics. So that when I talk about subjectivity, I'm usually using it in a very personal way to account for my subjectivity, but instead of saying my gender or genderless, or, you know, which I don't believe in, I talk about it in that sense. But I also mean it both ways in terms of a more common way of using it too. So it's kind of broad.
You mean your picture of yourself or your experience of the world?
My experience of the world is probably the best definition of
your individual experience.
Right, yeah. It's sort of like my speaking subject that can assume a multiplicity of viewpoints, and which is constructed in and through history and in and through discourse and all of those other isms that are very popular these days, which does have I only focus on Baudrillard tonight because I wanted to be sort of somewhat, as much as I could be, kind of specific. A lot of these other people have had the same ideas, they just haven't written them in this fashion, because certainly you could, if you read Baudrillard, at least in English, and I don't know whether it's the function of the translator or not, but you run into words from Althusser, words from Heidegger, phrases from Adorno, et cetera, all through it. So it's sort of, you know, when you read it, it really seems like, something that's not so original. But still, it's in terms of thinking in New York, there's a whole constellation of people who have taken this up. does deal with mass culture, and very few other people are, including Derrida or say people who might be more, or even Foucault, who's gone, instead of going towards mass culture, he's kind of gone back to this kind of archaeology of the past, which is very interesting, but it's very hard to pull, and that's exactly his project, it's very hard to pull that project into the 20th century to talk about the world we live in. And so people who, like me, who think of themselves as, you know, trying to be political a little bit, you know, are looking for someone whose ideas you can at least grapple with on some level, irregardless of whether you agree with them or not. Should I show altered states
at
the end of this? Did I answer your question? Excuse me. No, but did it? I can't pronounce your name. Did I answer your question?
I don't know. For some part.
Okay.
I'm sure, because she's also a specialist on alchemy.
Yeah, she probably doesn't.
It's very
funny. You are.
Thank you. doesn't really say how this can happen. And so it becomes the installation, you'll see. It's a sort of science fiction piece about the body and certain kinds of environmental spaces. Ken Shocker is about the shopping mall, and what was interesting in making this, and you'll sort of showing you sort of one section where it's pretty obvious how the whole thing works, is that I tried to take off from the point of view and the point of view shot, which is this shot that's has a specific look that's always claimed. It's not an unclaimed neutral camera look, but a claimed look where it implies a point of view shot. The classic one is sort of the horror movie where the killer is stalking the beautiful young woman. In this particular story, the woman is stalking someone in a shopping mall, and you'll see what happens whenever